VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another edition of the Game Podcast. On the show this week, we welcome back Allison Rudd, making his debut on the season's podcast. We have Mr. Matthew Syed, the two-time Olympian. And straight off the plane in Basel, where he's following the England team, it's Mr. Ollie Kay. On Friday, Fabio Capello talked about how the press helped him along in his journey from god to monster. After this 4-0 win over Bulgaria, is his divinity coming back, Ollie?
Well, some of us didn't quite characterise him as a monster after the World Cup. You know, we go from boom to bust in England, and I suppose on that basis, he's a god again after Friday night. But I think the same as I thought after the World Cup, that he's a very good manager who has a difficult job getting the best out of a fairly dysfunctional group of players. And Friday night was excellent, and roll on Switzerland on Tuesday, which looks a far more difficult task with that dysfunctional group of players having shown some of their dysfunctions again in the meantime.
Allison, was Friday night excellent, or were Bulgaria really poor?
But Bulgaria were slightly disappointing, because I thought they showed glimpses of having the ability to at least score, and it could have been all so different. But for Joe Hart, I thought he was staggeringly good, actually, and at each point that he had to make a good save, they were, you know, it was just crucial moments. And you could, the alternative universe, the parallel universe, was there hanging over the whole night. I felt that if Bulgaria had equalised, the Wembley crowd, you'd have heard the booing more. There was just a little bit of booing, you'd have heard a lot of booing. The players, who don't seem to be able to cope when things aren't going swimmingly, would have, I think, started to make poor decisions. So it was wafer thin, close to being another poor England performance. But for Joe Hart, who I think allowed England to play with a bit of spirit and verve.
Syed, what was it like? That was basically the difference between England's success and failure down to a 20-year-old goalkeeper, not Wayne Rooney, and his four assists.
I think Allison makes a very good point that sometimes seemingly inconsequential things can have dramatic ramifications. But having looked at the overall cutting thrust of the match, my feeling was that England were emphatically superior to a very poor Bulgaria side who kept giving the ball away in their third of the pitch. But I totally agree about Jermaine Defoe. His instinct in front of goal is fantastic. He has a palpable desire to kick the ball in the back of the net. He gets into good positions. And I think he knocked them all in with his left foot, which bodes very well. The fact that Rooney was dropping off and played a very creative role, I thought, was fantastic. But no, I think I'd probably disagree with Allison that it was wafer thin, but I do acknowledge the point that something small can happen and can trigger chaotically big consequences.
Ollie, your take on Defoe, is he some kind of long-term answer, or are you concerned about the fact that the guy gets hurt, that the guy is a midget, that, you know, we kind of assumed before that Rooney liked to play off somebody who could hold the ball up, which Defoe doesn't do?
Looking at his performances for England over the past sort of 18 months or 2 years, he and Rooney have very rarely combined well as a partnership. Certainly not the way they did the other night. And I've often felt that if you look at Rooney alongside Defoe as opposed to Rooney alongside Heskey, Rooney just doesn't seem to enjoy playing alongside certain players. I don't think he really hugely enjoys playing alongside Berbatov at United. Heskey brought the best out of Rooney, but did it bring the best out of the team? Defoe seems to, I mean, he's a fantastic finisher. He's the best finisher in the squad by some distance, I would say. He's also perhaps not as intelligent in what he does when England don't have the ball. He's not as good at closing down defenders. He's not as good at, you know, running into the channels, etc., occupying, stretching. What he's good at is just getting into the positions when his, you know, his teammates have the ball. And obviously that is the essence of being a goal scorer, but I think there will be times when Capello will look for something different from him.
Syed.
I just wanted to pick up on the very interesting question about this metamorphosis in the perception of Capello. And it's not just the fact that he has gone from God to clod because we've started losing, but the way we interpret his interaction with the players is fascinating. Before the World Cup, he was treating these players like children, banning tomato ketchup and doing all sorts of other things in terms of micromanaging their behaviour. This was construed as brilliant, absolutely fantastic, just what the players needed. During the World Cup, when results started going badly, precisely the same managerial technique was described as taking the fun out of it. It's a boot camp over there. So it's not just the fact that we reinterpret his ability as a coach, but the very same things that we were eulogising before the World Cup became terrible defects when we started losing at the World Cup.
But they didn't exist before the World Cup, Matt, because he never had them in one place for long enough. You know, the whole qualification campaign for the World Cup was sort of dipping in, dipping out. He could be as draconian as he liked with them, but he didn't have them for a night or two. But if the World Cup, you're there for four, well, longer than, well, no, not long. You could have been there for longer than 4 weeks. But they're holed up. They're holed up in a hostile environment because they didn't meet, no one liked the hotel. And then you find out what that tactic as a manager is really about when you've got them together.
So are you saying that that technique was a good thing before the World Cup, but because the players were away for a long time during the World Cup, it harmed their prospects? Or would you say that it wasn't really that relevant one way or the other, and that we are over-interpreting on the basis of the results? Because very few people said before the World Cup, if he does that at the World Cup, it's going to screw us up. It's almost always hindsight.
I would suggest, and I mean, I haven't been to a World Cup as a player, but I've been there as a journalist, I've spoken to players who were there, that it's extremely simple. I mean, the players who go to a World Cup are making sacrifices to be there. And if they win, it's worthwhile. If they win, they could live in a dungeon.
Exactly. I mean, yeah,
Spain had very, very Spartan accommodations for much of the World Cup. They didn't care because they were winning and they were on their way to win the World Cup. I think it's as simple as that. When you do badly, then you start talking about boredom and so on. I mean, am I wrong, Ollie?
No, I think you're absolutely right. To be honest, I think everybody's been right in exactly what they've just said. Matt, in terms of pointing out,
you're such a consensualist.
No, I've got to say the point that Matthew makes about the inconsistency in people, you know, pulling him up for things that they're praising for before the World Cup is spot on. The thing about perhaps Capello needing to manage things slightly differently during the World Cup is spot on. And I think the point that Gab makes, you know, if you look at that first game, if Robert Green hadn't built the ball into his own net, England would have won the first game. They would have had their tails up for that second week, in that long 6 days before their second game. I think it's a question of mood, and mood is dictated by results. And you think, well, what comes first? I think going into the World Cup, the boot camp mentality wasn't really a problem. It became a problem because of the results, rather than the other way around.
Big story this weekend in my favourite Sunday tabloid newspaper. In fact, more than one, actually. But funny enough, it was an exclusive in both, which I always find somewhat remarkable. Wayne Rooney's alleged relationship with a professional girlfriend, can we call her that?
You're so quaint. Good.
Well, what I find interesting is, to my understanding, and Ollie, I think you can confirm this, Rooney found out that these allegations were going to come out on Sunday, on Friday afternoon, in other words, before the Bulgaria game. I'm not sure if the England staff knew at the time, but certainly the player himself did. And he goes out on the pitch and plays phenomenally well. And my mind goes back to John Terry when he had his little problem. And, you know, next game out he goes and he scored away from home. I think it might have been at Bolton or somewhere up north.
Burnley,
sorry. Close enough, right? Is there something in footballers' minds that even though they get this news, which I think for most of us would be, you know, potentially, you know, earth-shattering or certainly a huge problem, they just go out on the pitch and in the pitch they isolate themselves?
No, you've put your finger on it, Gab. It's because they've become these massive egos who believe everything that's written, that's good, that's written about them. They are adored by millions and millions of people around the world. Imagine you have people with your name on their shirt. They're wearing your... Goodness knows what that does to your mentality and your ego. And I think John Terry, as someone who's slightly older, I think he sort of personifies it perfectly as someone who feels he's beyond normal bounds of morality. That man does not think losing the England captaincy or having a very public affair with a teammate's girlfriend matters at all. He's above it all. He believes he's a some sort of God figure, and that is why they can then go out and play darned well on the football pitch, because they're not like you and I who worry about whether our children are happy at school or whether our boyfriend or husband or wife or girlfriend are getting on okay in the office. They're not like us. They have these monstrous egos.
In defense of Mr. Terry, it was a former teammate's former girlfriend, and she has denied the affair took place and he hasn't spoken about it. So the only reason we know that this supposedly happened is because the newspapers wrote about it and have not yet been sued, although legal action is going on. Just to be fair about whether this actually took place or not. Syed.
Well, a couple of things. One, I have a T-shirt with Ali's name on the back of it. On the compartmentalisation, I think certain players and certain people in life just are very good at pigeonholing difficulties rather than dwelling on it and allowing it to insidiously affect how they behave at work. And I think there are certain footballers who are good at that, others probably not very good. The larger and more important question is whether it is legitimate for the newspapers to pry into the private lives of footballers. And I think there's a pretty important distinction to be made. You mentioned JT. I think, assuming it's true, that revelation, and the News of the World must have thought it was true to publish the story, was utterly legitimate for the following reason. Terry had his agent send out an email to potential sponsors eulogising about Terry's position as the daddy sauce dad of the year. In other words, he was trying to lucratively trade on his public image as a good family man. And in those circumstances, if there is private behaviour that contradicts that public image, it is perfectly legitimate and in the public interest for it to come out. I mean, the law is...
What's the public interest here?
Well, in this particular case, it's rather more difficult, which is why the law is right to say there should be an intense scrutiny case by case, and it should be
quite straightforward in the Rooney case, because Rooney has gone public and sold and made money out of the fact that he slept with prostitutes in the past, and he's managed to somehow dress it up as one of those things you do when you're a bit young, and I'm not going to do it again, and it's made me a better person, and I'm now devoted to my wife, and he's made money from that interview. How can you then go to the courts and say, oh, I've done it again, and I don't want people to know this time?
I think that's a really good point, and that would be precisely the case that would be put by the News of the World, that he's demonstrating hypocrisy in his actions if he's trying to conceal information.
Well, that's what they did, and that's why it's in the paper.
Ollie, getting back to the build-up to the game, I mean, on Friday, Rooney's made aware of it, maybe even earlier, but he certainly knew as of Friday. Did you guys know? Was there any sense in the camp that this was about to come out? Was there any concern about how it might affect Rooney?
No, there was nothing of that filtering out on Friday. And to be honest, there's been a bit of a conflict in terms of times and dates, in terms of information coming about when he did know about it. Some people have said he found out that this was going to be run on Saturday, so after the game. So I'm not sure which of those is 100% correct, but clearly one of them is. I'm more interested in his... I mean, we also saw how he played on Friday. I thought he was excellent. But how does he play tomorrow night? I mean, when we talk about compartmentalising, it was probably easier to put that out of his mind on Friday, before the whole enormity of the thing had sunk in, before it's splashed over the papers, etc. How easy is it to do that on Tuesday night in Basel, in a difficult game, in a hostile atmosphere, when now the whole country is talking about it? You know, we're talking about it here, even though we'd probably rather not in some ways.
One point I wanted to make, a sad point from the game, was seeing Michael Dawson get injured. I mean, obviously, it's always ugly when you see players get injured on television. He's going to be out a couple of months. It'll have an impact on his club side, no doubt. But just in the immediate, with Terry and Ferdinand still out, although I'm not sure we should ever mention that Ferdinand's injured, because, of course, we should probably just tell you when he's fit. What happens in central defense against Switzerland, and how do you feel about it, Ollie?
Well, if you looked at what Capello did on Friday night, he had Gary Cahill as the substitute centre half on the bench. He didn't have Matthew Epson in the squad, which raised the odd eyebrow in the sort of press room beforehand. And then obviously Cahill had to come on for what was, you know, a fairly demanding debut. I thought he looked a little uncomfortable going in for that last half hour. But to be honest, and it won't sound charitable to say it in circumstances, I thought Dawson looked uncomfortable at times. I didn't think he had a brilliant game prior to the injury. And to me, that central defence is a concern. I think it was a concern before the game. And although they got away with it on Friday night, look at the number of good chances Bulgaria created. I wouldn't trust them as implicitly as I would Terry and Ferdinand going into this match in Basel.
We haven't got any choice, have we?
No choice at all. Mm.
Well, you do have a choice. You could play Lescott, I suppose, if you wanted to. Of course, Cahill and Jagielka, much like Lescott, weren't even at the World Cup, which makes me think that they were fifth, sixth, and seventh choice at best for Mr. Capello 2 months ago. All right, this week's debate goes back to something we've heard many times, club v. country. I'm interested in one thing, and I'm going to start with something Olympian related, so pay attention, Mr. Syed. One of the ways that that this huge London 2012 was sold to the nation and the people paying the bills was, look, it'll inspire everybody, it'll make us feel good, it'll make us fitter, blah, blah, blah. And I'm wondering, in a footballing sphere, what is more of an effect, success for the clubs or success for the national team, if we buy that there is an equation between the success you see on television and your own sort of sporting success? And I want to hear from you, Matthew, but I want to start with Ollie Kay in Basel.
I think if you talk about the national psyche, the national confidence as a whole, I think unquestionably an England World Cup win would do far more for national happiness than, for example, a Manchester United or a Liverpool or a Chelsea or an Arsenal Champions League win. I mean, but if you ask the people who are directly, who follow those clubs, I think most of them would rather their team win the Champions League. Some wouldn't, but I think to answer your question, I think yes, there would be this huge upsurge in sort of public happiness, confidence, call it what you like, if England were to win a World Cup, or if England, or if Great Britain were to do fantastically well at the Olympics. But I don't think it is necessarily the first priority in everybody's mind.
But Ollie, can I just take you back to what you said, because that's interesting. What proportion of, I think everyone knows that Liverpool fans generally put Liverpool before England, just something
and
we've
United,
always done.
United
but,
likewise.
But do you think what proportion of Manchester United fans, bearing in mind it's not just the season ticket holders, what proportion of Manchester United fans, people who say they are Manchester United fans who are English, would prefer Man United to win the Champions League than for England to win the World Cup? What percentage terms do you think that would break down into?
I've no idea. I wouldn't care to guess about percentages like that.
I think there'd be more people saying they want England to win the World Cup.
Well, similarly, I don't think you should presume that the hardcore of Manchester United support would feel that way. I think if you ask Newcastle supporters, I mean, Newcastle is probably seen by some as a more patriotic city, despite the sort of Geordie Nation mythology. But I mean, if you ask a Newcastle fan, what would you rather happen? England win the World Cup or England win European Championship, or Newcastle win a trophy for the first time since whatever it is, 43 BC. these things matter to people. But there are fans out there who've never seen their team play in the Premier League, which might end up being a miserable experience. But England as a team, I don't think it stirs the emotions of the whole nation like we wish it would.
Syed.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, just picking up on the opening question. First of all, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that either hosting an Olympic Games or any individuals being successful in an Olympic Games increases sporting participation. And neither is there any evidence that, for example, winning the Rugby World Cup increases general sporting participation. What tends to happen is that rugby just poaches from other sports, so the overall level of participation stays the same. So the argument in favour of a public subsidy is sort of massively reduced, and all this stuff that we hear is genuinely just hot air. Club v country, I think when England play in the World Cup, it is one of the, in the Football World Cup, it is one of the few genuinely shared national occasions. There are, you know, in a sort of liberal, atomistic society, there's very little that brings us together in a common cause. Politics divides us, religion divides us. Football is one of the few things when our 11 players are playing in their England shirts on the world stage where we can pull together.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And glimpse a rather old-fashioned concept, patriotism. So I think it is very important, and it's very important beyond sport in terms of our national life. Club success, I think, is different and more complex. It clearly only affects a very narrow caucus. When Manchester United win, a lot of the rest of the country, other than the United fans, are rather upset by that. So I think it's probably fair to say that the England success is going to resonate far wider than Manchester United success or Liverpool success or Chelsea success. But I also think the way we relate to the success of our national team or the success of our clubs is very different. And I think the club identity is often far more complex.
Well, what I find interesting, and I go back to, you know, the question before between Alison and Ollie about what fans would rather want, what Manchester United fans would rather want. I mean, surely to some degree, whether you've experienced a success before matters or not. I come from a country that won two World Cups in my lifetime. Y'all come from a country that probably didn't win any in your lifetimes.
That's a compliment, by the way, to us.
I think it's also right. True. So obviously, if I'm a Manchester United fan and I won a couple Champions Leagues in the last decade, I might say, yeah, whatever. Let's win a World Cup. Let's see what that's like. But if I'm an Arsenal fan and I won nothing, then I might feel differently about it, no?
But, you know, I'm tempted to say that it's a redundant question. In other words, you can want England to win and Manchester United to win. You can want England to win and Liverpool to win. You know, why ask the question, you know, do you want England to win more than your child getting a grade A in his A-level? I mean, you know, we just want them both. But I think it is important. I was tempted to say that, but in actual fact, I'm not going to say that because you're right, there are sometimes conflicts. In other words, what would you prefer? Would you prefer Rooney to stop playing for England so that compete more effectively for Manchester United, or Paul Scholes, pretty relevant example at the moment. So that conflict does manifest itself in ways that can genuinely harm the prospects of one or the other. And I guess, you know, so far as the club owners are concerned, they are paying the wages of these players. The England team is not paying the majority of the wages, and so they will feel that their assets are potentially being undermined or injured in the case of Michael Dawson in ways that are directly contradictory to the financial interests of the club.
Ollie?
Just to answer that question, I think there's a feeling that at times maybe they are mutually exclusive. You know, you have to choose. English football has to choose between club success and international success, and it is clearly made a choice that club success is more important, or the domestic league is more important. But then you look at Spain, the success that they've enjoyed at club level as well over the past decade, while for the first time in, you know, certainly my lifetime, having an extremely good dominant national team. So it clearly can be done. But if I'm looking at England's match in Basel as being a difficult game, I see it being difficult primarily because you've got players like John Terry and Frank Lampard missing because they've had operations that, or resting injuries that they've played with through the first few easy-ish Premier League games of the season. There is just not the prioritisation of the national team that there would be in other countries.
Well, what's interesting there, you made an interesting analogy there with Spain, because actually for most of their history, Spain were sort of the byword of clubs dominating over a nation. And there's also, of course, political reasons for that with the Basques and Catalonia somehow thinking, they're a different nation. And it's about the same time, you know, their clubs whooped everybody's rear ends, and Spain basically only qualified for one out of every two international competitions. And then it all came together. What I'm wondering about, did this coming together, was it maybe just down to the fact that, you know, in the case of Spain, you know, they had two outstanding leaders within the squad, one Catalan, one Castilian, one from Real Madrid, one from Barcelona, who'd grown up together and decided, let's keep a lid on a rivalry and let's just come together for this tournament. And in reality, it had nothing to do with the national psyche. And by the way, the two guys I'm referring to are Xavi and Iker Casillas.
Well, there's also the fact that they've probably got the most talented the most talented players in world football at the moment.
Fantastic, aren't they?
Many of whom play together at Barcelona, and the guys who augment that from Real Madrid and elsewhere. You know, they're not.
Well, it is like watching Barcelona when you watch Spain, isn't it? And when you watch England, it's not like watching Arsenal or Manchester United, is it? So that's the difference.
It's just just one quick comment. It is so beautiful watching them play. I'm not sure that there's anything in world sport, even Roger Federer playing tennis in his pomp, that is more engaging emotionally and aesthetically than Barcelona. I watched them play the other week when Iniesta, you know, the ball was punched out and he volleyed it instinctively into the back of the net, the Messi chip. I mean, the fluency and intricacy of their passing is so joyous. It's incredible.
Back to club v country, I want to throw something out that I threw out to Simon Barnes, and he liked it, so I'm going to throw it back out to all of you.
When did you do this?
This was a couple of years ago, actually, in conversation with Mr. Barnes. In my experience, when I've run into people who have pretty strong opinions about whether they'd rather see their club side do well or whether they care about their club side more than their national team, I found a correlation, and yes, here, I'm going to get all psychobabble on you, Syed, which is people who tend to love their mothers more than their partners tend to want their national team to do better.
Freud has arrived in the studio. What is going on here?
Whereas people who actually love their significant other more, whether it's a man or a woman or a sheep or a dog or whatever, those people tend to care more.
Name and shame. Who do you know who admits to loving their mother more than their wife?
I know a lot of people. Well, most single people I know, for example.
You mean the ones without wives? Gabby, you're struggling.
That's not true. I know a lot. Maybe it's because I come from a Mediterranean culture where our mothers are very important to us. You know, but I think a lot of people love their mums.
Would you stand in the pub with a pint of lager and go, "Hello, mate, do you love your mother more than you love your missus?" That's a load of nonsense.
I'm a sensitive man. You obviously love Mr. Schmidt more than Mr. Rudd, but so what? You know, or Mrs. Well, Rudd. Sorry, Ali.
Well, do we have any evidence of Oedipus's thoughts on club v country?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it?
The reason the analogy was there, and I think the reason Barnes liked it was that you can't choose your mother. Your mother's imposed upon you, the same way you can't choose your country, with very few exceptions. your club, you can argue, no, well, I can't choose it because my dad took me to go and watch Scunthorpe when I was 4 years old. But in reality, we all know that that's not really true. We tell ourselves that we can't really choose our club, but in fact, we can. I mean, people don't always support their local club. People don't always support the first club they saw. So in the same way you've chosen your significant other or your mate to some degree, you've sort of to some degree chosen your club.
But you think that's what, I mean, you said that when you support a club, you often tell yourself a narrative that it was part of your identity, a sort of a facet of who you are.
The same way that when you fall in love, you tell yourself that it was fate and blah, 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 and this is the one and so on.
What a kind of fatalistic approach. I remember reading Tony Evans's very good book about Liverpool, Far Foreign Land, and there was a line in it that I think really conveyed the essence of club devotion. It was something like, and I'm going to get this totally wrong, from the moment my heart first started beating, my love for Anfield registered in my consciousness. In other words, I think the strength of the club loyalty hinges on the idea that it is central to the DNA of who you are, and that it wasn't some promiscuous choice of walking into a bar and picking a club off the shelf.
But he can tell himself that it was from the moment he was born. But I mean, plenty of people are born in exactly the same circumstances as Tony Evans in Liverpool and ends up supporting Everton.
Yeah.
Right?
But yeah, I am purely English. I have no non-English ancestry. I'm English, but I grew up supporting Italy. I didn't want to be English. You can ditch your nationality if you want.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, there
that's
are
true.
Rare exceptions where there are certain point. National teams that are just so appealing that they can't have crossover appeal. Ollie?
If it's confession time, I remember supporting Scotland perhaps more than England at the 1982
Ollie,
World Cup.
Ollie, I tell you, that's a terrible weird. Admission for the football correspondent of the Times. Goodness me.
Terrible.
Like, we're going to puff that on page one tomorrow. Kay supports Scotland.
What I can conclude here is that both Rudd and Kay have issues with their mothers. Syed, have you always supported England?
Yeah, I think I have.
And
yeah.
You love your mother very much.
I do.
More than your significant other.
No, I'm not. This is a ridiculous choice that I'm having to make here on air. Absolutely
but
absurd.
As much.
I love them in different ways, guys.
There you go. Different ways. All right. Final thought on this club v country thing is, it's been said many times, and sometimes when you go to England games and you see the banners, you might think that there's actually a greater affinity from fans of lower league clubs with the England team.
Well, it's an actual physical relationship. I was at Griffin Park yesterday, and at halftime they played Vindaloo, which is one of the 98 England World Cup songs. And they were playing it because England had done well, and Brentford wanted to be part of England's success, current success. Whereas you'd never get an England anthem played at half time at a big Premiership club because they don't see themselves as part of England's success.
Yeah,
it's completely separate. You know, we are Arsenal, we are Chelsea, and we just focus on us and how wonderful we are and how rich we are and how we are all consuming and you've all paid a lot of money to sit here and we're all about blue is the colour. Whereas the lower down you go, fans go along, the sort of fan you get at somewhere like Griffin Park, they're equivocal, aren't they? Yeah, I love Brentford and I love England. And they don't see a contradiction because their players are never injured on England duty. And often it just means they have more people come to see them on an international weekend because they're the ones who don't have to rest because it's international weekend. And so there's a nice relationship there. England are doing well and they can watch their team and the England team and it's lovely.
Maybe there's also an issue of, if you're a fan of a big club, you get so much experience and exposure to big games, big occasions. And if you're a supporter who goes to watch, if you're a supporter as opposed to a fan, if you go abroad, you go to every game, whatever, that costs a hell of a lot of money. Whereas if you're a fan of a lower league team, it doesn't cost as much money. You don't have the foreign trips, etc. It stands to reason that you probably have more disposable income to spend on following the national team, as well as probably more excitement to be gained from it because you're not getting your kicks elsewhere.
Syed, I find this to be a peculiarly English thing in the sense that what tends to happen in most other countries is supporters of small clubs are equally indifferent or into the national team as supporters of big clubs. The main difference is that supporters of small clubs, they'll adopt a big club as their second club, but you don't seem to have the special relationship between sort of the smaller clubs or the grassroots, even for lack of a better word, and the very pinnacle of the pyramid, which is England.
It's sort of a big financial as well as an emotional schism.
That's
between
right.
the very best and the rest. Yeah, I think that's probably a fair point. And just coming back to the whole club v country issue, just one thing that I thought was relevant here is that we often think that if we can either have one or the other. We can either have a successful national team or a successful league. And you made the point that Spain somehow sort of demolishes that idea. I think we should be very, very careful of undermining the Premier League. It is one of the great free market success stories. And if we were, for example, to start banning foreign players or changing the way that the Premier League is structured, it could have very dangerous negative ramifications, not just for the league, not just for sport in this country, but also, I think, potentially for the national team too. I think if we had less foreign players, if it was a less strong league, that would affect the quality of our national team in a negative way. And there's a lot of evidence to support that.
And let's not pretend that when the league was less successful commercially, etc., in the 80s, you know, early 90s, etc., let's not pretend that England were doing brilliantly then.
People Precisely.
Would say Euro 96, etc., but, yeah. You know, when the league clubs were doing... We're doing well in the late 70s, etc. But the national team wasn't qualifying for tournaments.
Yeah.
There's no real rhyme or reason to that. It's just that I think the Premier League has become sort of all-consuming, and perhaps in the minds of some of the players as well.
This wraps up our club v country debate. All right, time for some quick hits, which some people insist on calling off the fence. According to the column I wrote in today's Times, transfer spending is down nearly 40% across Europe's five biggest leagues, something which Michel Platini, the UEFA boss, hailed as, quote, a return to reality. Ollie, are you surprised? And is this good for football or just good for the owners?
I think it's got to be a good thing that football is being less extravagant. If you look at the past decade, there have been some ludicrous absolutely carefree, inconsiderate spending at times, and it's jeopardised clubs' futures. There are other issues that have jeopardised clubs' futures, such as ownership and dangerous ownership models, but generally, across the board, a more sensible, rational approach to transfers is a good thing.
Much agreed. I think also transfers will come down once financial fair play kicks in.
Indeed.
A little detour for Mr. Syed. We've seen with the Pakistan no-ball scandal the havoc that fixers and gambling can wreak on sport. Is football entirely safe from this? Should the game be doing more to keep gambling away? Keep the merchants out of the temple, so to speak?
Quite. And yes, I think it is a massive issue. Spot fixing in particular for football and for sport. I suspect it will replace illegal doping as the biggest threat to the integrity of sport going forward. And yes, the game should be doing everything it can, although there's not a huge amount it can do about unlicensed gambling establishments colluding with players, but everything it can to get on top of it.
Oh, fantastic. That's why we've got bookmakers sponsoring entire leagues and teams. Wonderful. Gerard Houllier is strongly linked to the Aston Villa job, either as a director of football or manager. Alison, you got to experience his body of work up close at Liverpool. Would this be a good move for the Villa?
I'd like to stress I never experienced his body, although he was one of the more charming managers I ever dealt with. He was always terribly polite and courteous, and he gave me Stevie G's shirt when he would... the first night that Stevie G was made captain for my birthday present, so I'm very fond of Gerard Houllier. But he, after winning five trophies in 2001 at Liverpool, eventually he stagnated there and he stalled at Lyon. And I sort of think he suits Villa because they're not going to make top four and he'll keep them in UEFA Cup places.
John Toshack is expected to resign after more difficulty for Wales. And there's a remarkable suggested replacement, Mr. Ryan Giggs. Ollie, can you shed more light on this startling development?
Yeah, apparently Toshack's intention is to resign after the October qualifiers, if not before, and that his intention is to recommend Ryan Giggs do the job, which to me sounds unlikely. And it also sounds to me an unlikely... recommendation from Toshack, because I remember reporting on the Wales team for several years when Mark Hughes was manager, and Toshack, who was out of work at the time, was telling anybody who listened that you needed experience to be a national manager. He was very critical of Hughes, and you can guess who he thought was the experienced manager that he thought should be doing the job. I think he's found it a lot more difficult than he...
Super Mario Balotelli crashed his car last week and was later questioned by police, who asked him why he had £5,000 in cash in his vehicle, to which he simply replied, "I'm very wealthy," which he is. Matthew, is there a broader lesson to take from this? And why can't Super Mario simply carry a credit card like most rich people I know?
That's a very good question. The broader lesson, I think, in all of this is carry a credit card in case you get stopped by the police and you're potentially suspected. I suppose the implication of this is suspected of wanting to buy drugs. Or the alternative is for the police not to be so suspicious, or for footballers not to be given access to very fast cars.
West Ham are bottom of the table, so David Sullivan speaks up with some very helpful comments, like questioning the commitment of the club's foreign players. Alison, Mr. Sullivan pays the bills alongside your friend Mr. Gold, but so obviously he's entitled to his opinion, but should owners be so public with their criticism?
No, that's the short answer. Slightly longer. If people are openly critical of players, what you do is you stick it up on the dressing room wall and you say, "Let's go and prove that critic wrong," and they usually play better. But if it's your own owner saying it, it's you can't do that. It's just counterproductive. So I'm struggling to find a good reason why it would work for him to do so.
Well, yes, Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Gold staring a slightly dangerous path towards relegation, something they've already experienced twice, of course, at Birmingham City.
Gab, one for you. The Australian FA has used retrospective video evidence to ban two players who won penalties by diving. I thought this was the kind of thing FIFA frowned upon. So how are they getting away with it?
Well, I think this is another example of FIFA sort of contradicting itself, because when the Scottish FA wanted to do something like that a while back, they were advised not to. But then, of course, we had the Eduardo case. I think this is a great idea in principle, and it's great that the Australian FA, a league I think most people outside Australia don't really care much about, is allowed to experiment with it. But what we found in the past when this has happened, witness Eduardo and earlier in Serie A when we had these rules, it's nearly impossible to tell if somebody was actually physically had the intention to cheat.
He did it just in time.
Did-a-ding.
That's it for this week. Thanks as ever for downloading this podcast. Remember, you can get more news, views, and opinion at thetimes.co.uk. And you can also follow many of the Times writers, including yours truly, on Twitter. I'm at Marcotti. Oliver K is at Oliver K Times. There's also James Ducker, George Calkin, a whole host of them. But we'll be back next Monday when the Premiership campaign gets back underway, and we'll have more guests on to pick apart the weekend's action. Till then, au revoir.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.